Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the subject of property when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who can't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most of the students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real, honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedures, available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Then just click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. When we talk about property, which is the holy grail, by the way, of Anglo-Saxon administration, we think of our homes, don't we? And we think of our property tax. I mean, after all, we pay property tax on our homes, the land that our houses sit on. Sometimes we might even think of our automobiles as being property or some chattel, like a snowmobile or maybe a radio or some other particular object, television sets and so on. And that's certainly true. The word property, when we look it up in the dictionary, covers those tangible objects. But there's another term used in law called the subject of property. Subject. It's not the property itself, it's the right or rights that attach to the tangible property itself. For instance, an easement going across a piece of land. The guy who has the right to the easement doesn't pay taxes on that particular piece of land. He doesn't own it. And he might not even be able to graze his cattle on it, but he does have certain rights that attach to it. And those rights are saleable, transferable. They can be disposed of, they can be used and enjoyed, but it isn't the particular property itself. He doesn't own the rock, the minerals, or the earth, but he owns the right to walk across this piece of land, to drive across it. In short, rights are the subject of property. Now, in our Constitution here in the United States, one of the things that we're guaranteed is the right to life, the right to liberty, and the right to the pursuit of happiness. Now, the reason that I have a right to life is because I have a guarantee by a law that says, thou shalt do no murder. I have a right to my corporal and incorporeal properties with a law that says, thou shalt not steal. So, if you want to take my watch away from me, that's a crime, unless you can get me to sell it to you, give it to you, throw it away so that you can find it at a later time. In other words, I've got to do something positive in order to alienate myself from my property so that you can take possession of it without the violation of that law. Now, just in case you didn't know this, if you steal something from somebody, there's a law that says thou shalt not steal, and there's a penalty that goes along with it. You can't have a law without a penalty. If you could have a law without a penalty. You wouldn't have a law, you would have a suggestion. A law has to have a penalty. Otherwise, we don't have a law. So if the law says thou shalt not steal, the guy that made that law up enforces it with a penalty of 2 times the amount that you steal. So if you steal my car, it isn't the value of the car that's at issue. It is the property itself, the car. You don't owe me the value of the car, son. You owe me the car. Period. End of report. And if for some reason you cannot return my car, then you have to give me 2 cars. If, in fact, you can return my car, then you just owe me 1 car. You give me back my car and 1 more. So that's the penalty for theft. Now, in the event that this is a little heavier duty theft, say it went a little bit beyond an ordinary theft, and now we've got a misdemeanor, then you owe me 4 cars. In some cases, you could owe me 5 cars. And in one extreme case of theft, that's where you steal food, you owe me 7 times the amount that you steal. Now, we get that from the Creator himself. So when somebody steals something, he has an automatic penalty to pay. And most people believe, in most cases, that when they steal and they're crafty and careful about it. You know, it's kind of like sex. You want to practice safe sex. Sometimes we want to practice safe theft. And so we go out and we steal something like an insurance settlement or maybe taxes. You know, we don't pay all of our taxes. Well, these penalties for theft, for instance, are automatic. It doesn't require a policeman. You don't have to have somebody with a radar gun out there watching you, or with motion detectors or cameras on the street corner so that we can catch you stealing. These laws are enforced by God himself automatically. I had a guy one time, he owed me some money. So I sent him a letter. Every 7 years I have to send out letters to people that haven't paid me, because there's a statute that tells us in Numbers chapter 30 that what proceeds out of your mouth can't return again. So when somebody says, hey, I'm going to pay you this or that, he has 6 years with which to pay. So when the year of release comes up, it's obligatory on my part to forgive this guy the debt. Yeah, I'm not kidding you. I don't sue these people for the debt. I have to forgive it. So I write him a letter, send it by certified mail, and I say, now listen, Bob, you owe me X amount, and you haven't paid me. Now, this is my final demand. This is the land Sabbath year, and you need to pay this. You agreed to, and you didn't pay me yet. And if you don't pay me, I'm going to forgive you the debt. How would you like to get a letter like that? Well, now, the average Joe Sixpack would say, wow, that's a hell of a neat deal. Then I got the goods, and I don't have to pay for them. Oh, yeah, you got to pay for it. And what will happen to you is that you'll pay for it when the engine of your car blows up, or when a tornado comes through and rips through your house and knocks it down, or a Hurricane Katrina comes, or a flood comes like we just saw over in Nashville. These are called acts of God. That's the way the insurance company writes it up in their policies, in their contracts. They say, well, we're not responsible now for acts of God. What we do there is we put that on the general taxpayers, the taxpaying public, and we have the government come out, declare this to be a disaster area, and then everybody gets to share in the punishment of the thieves who have been punished by the natural disaster. So over the years, realizing that there is a penalty to pay, if I were to receive a letter from you and you said, hey, Gordon, you owe me some money, and if you don't pay me, I'm going to forgive you, I would write a letter back by certified mail and say, no, Bob, don't forgive the debt. I promise I will pay you all that I owe. Be patient with me. And let me light your cigarettes, pour your coffee. Let me pick up your rocks, build your fence, or do anything to satisfy this debt. The reason for that is, if, perchance, you legitimately fell on hard times and you can't pay the debt, the purpose for the land Sabbath and Jubilees is to release you from that debt so that we don't hold you longer than 7 years. So, you know, if we did that in the United States, instead of foreclosing on these people's homes and throwing them out in the street, we would forgive them the debt and they'd walk off debt-free. That's a hell of a deal, isn't it? It's one of the credit statutes that God gave us at Mount Sinai. But if, on the other hand, you could have paid the debt, but you didn't. You put forth your hand, you struck an agreement with somebody, you could pay, but you refused to pay, saying in your wicked heart, aha, the year of release is at hand, and he'll have to forgive me the debt. I've got the goods, and now because of the year of release, he can't collect it, and so therefore I get away with it. I get the house, and I don't have to give up my money in payment for it. That then converts this to a theft. This credit transaction becomes a theft. Big Mike then comes into the picture, and then he'll exact the penalty from you 2 times, 4 times, 5 times, or 7 times the amount of the debt. So when you get a letter from me, partner, and it says, if you don't pay me, I'm going to forgive you the debt, I'm not doing you any favors. That is a curse. So take it any way you want it. Because property is so serious, it is so important, that in the scope of Anglo-Saxon administration, it is the subject of the law. It is the law. It's the most important part of the law. It's the right to property. Without it, you can't have liberty. You can't have rights without property. So the protection of property is the number one issue that we see in the Ten Commandment model that we talk about here often, compared with the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now, when we talk about the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto, it is the antithesis of property. In fact, the very first plank of the Communist Manifesto goes like this. It calls for the abolition of property in land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. So coming right out of the chute, we don't want you to own any property. We're going to do away with property. You can't have property. And in those countries where we practice the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes, we don't have liberty. We find that in Russia and China. And we're finding it to a greater extent now in Canada, the United States, and Great Britain, and Western Europe, as we adopt these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and as we replace the 10 commandments, we find that we have less and less liberty, less and less property, more and more taxes, more and more government control, bigger and bigger government, more and more socialism, more and more of all the things that we complain about and say, hey, we don't like, don't want, can't use, and shouldn't have. Now, most of us, when we think of the term property, we think of our property tax. We think of our land, our homes, and et cetera. And we use terms like my home, my car, my child, as if this is mine to the exclusion of everybody else. This is something that belongs to me, and you can't have it. It's really selfish. Young mothers, when they're out on the playground, and a little child has a truck and he's out playing with it, and some other little kid comes over here, and maybe he's a little bigger, and he sees it, and he says, well, I want it. So he just takes it. Ever seen it? That's like playing over in Ronnie Mitchell's sandbox, you know. And Ronnie Mitchell, being an A number one communist, you know, he said, you're playing in my sandbox, and you have to play by my rules. And so I asked him, I said, well, Ronnie, what are your rules? Well, my rules are I get to play with whatever toys I want to. And I thought about that for a minute. Now, I didn't have a sandbox, but I had some pretty neat toys. See, I was an only child, and so Christmas time came, you know, and I got this real neat kind of Tonka toy. It was a real neat truck. And so I'm over here at Ronnie Mitchell's, you know, and Ronnie wants to play with my truck, and I'm playing in his sandbox, and he says to me, hey, give me your truck. I'm going to play with your truck, and you can play with mine. He had this broken down piece of trash, and this is his sandbox. Now, I got to admit, I got to tell you, Ronnie Mitchell's sandbox was probably more valuable than my Tonka toy, but I got to tell you, what's mine is mine, and I ain't about to share it. So I picked up my toy, selfish little dude that I was, and I left Ronnie Mitchell's sandbox, never to return again. I said, Ronnie, you can take your sandbox and stick it where there's no daylight. And I think I was about 4 or 5 years old. Now, Ronnie was a nice kid, and I'm not running Ronnie down, but I'm just telling you, you know, little kids, you know, they recognize property and property rights. They also recognize just brute force. I want it, and I'm going to take it. How do I get that truck away from little Georgie? I know. You can't play in my sandbox if you don't let me play with your toy. So little children don't have the sense of share and share alike. Now, young mothers do. And so when these kinds of events transpire, young mothers come along, now, little Georgie, you share your toy with Ronnie. And then Mrs. Mitchell would come out, well, now, Ronnie, you don't talk to little Georgie like that. You share your sandbox. See, these young mothers are all communists, and they want to practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Little children don't want to do that. They want to practice private property rights. They want to practice negotiation. And Ronnie was negotiating in good faith. You know, I've got the sandbox, you got the truck. You know, you want to play in my sandbox, Georgie, you let me play with your truck. Little Georgie's sitting over here saying, hey, the terms and conditions here are unacceptable. I'm going to take my truck and go play by myself, and you can take that sandbox and you know what you can do with it. So little children understand property and property rights a whole lot better than mothers do. Mothers, for the most part, are communists, socialists. They want to practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, and the little kid wants to play with his truck. Wants to play with his sandbox. Now, if we were to take a look at your home, you know, you said, hey, this is my home. This is my house. You know, when I come over to your house, you say, well, come on, let me show you through my house. Let me show you through my home. Here's what I'm doing down in the basement. I'm remodeling my basement, and then I just put a new roof on my house, and I just bought this house, and I'm remodeling it, and here's what I paid for it, and here's what I hope to sell it for, and we talk about it in a possessive manner. We say, mine, 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 mine. Now, there are some competing interests that have an interest in your house. For instance, your local county assessor, he has an interest. He comes out every once in a while and says, hey, I think this house is worth $100,000, and I think we need to set a property tax on it, and we think you need to rent this from the county and pay us $500 a year. Now, we call this the property tax. And what happens if you don't pay this property tax? Did you go down to the county assessor and say, now listen, I want to pay my fair share to run the county government? And I insist that you charge me $500. In fact, you don't even need to charge me. Let me come in and donate $500 every year to the operation of the county. Have you ever done that? You know, as old as I am, I never have. And so the county, knowing that you're not going to volunteer to come down, pay your $500 and pay your fair share, they send somebody out, and using the police powers of the state, they give you an ultimatum. They just simply tell you, we're going to charge you $500 a year, and if you don't pay it, God help you. We'll take your house away from you and sell it on the courthouse steps. And then you say, well, you know, you try and do something like that, boy, and you're going to face the wrath of little Georgie. And they say, hey, listen, we'll send out the sheriff and five deputies, and if you give us any static, we will pry your cold, dead fingers right off of your cold, dead gun, and then we'll take your house. It comes up once in a while. It's not too often, but sometimes, you know, the sheriff has to come out, enforce the tax, and take the guy's house. Now, let me ask you this. If the state can come in and take your house away from you by force and violence, can you tell me that you own that house? It looks like to me that the state has a superior claim to your house. Now, there's another guy that comes into the picture. Maybe it's the bank, or maybe it's the savings and loan company, and they send you a letter, and they say, hey, Bob, you didn't pay us your $500 payment this month. And if you don't pay us your $500 payment, we're going to evict you from your house and take it away from you. This is your mortgage, you know. Now, assuming that you get uppity and you say, well, I ain't paying this mortgage. This is my house. Who do you think you are sending me a bill? And so you don't pay your mortgage, and then they go into court, and they file a complaint, and you go through some process over here. Pretty soon, you get the same result. The sheriff comes out, and he says, all right, Bob, it's time for you to leave. And he just takes the house away from you, and this is called a foreclosure. Let me ask you this. Is this your house? Are you telling me you own this house? Is that your position? Now, when we take a look at some of these things that we claim to own, and then we take a look at these prior claims upon it, you know, it raises some serious questions. It kind of works that way with your car, too. Let's suppose that you've got a car, and you're making car payments on this, and one day you don't make your car payments, and a couple months goes by, and pretty soon the Ford Motor Finance or GMAC comes along, they just snatch your car right off the road. You ever notice that? You go out in your driveway, and your car's gone. You call the sheriff or the police, and you say, hey, my car's been stolen. No, it's been repossessed. You didn't pay your payments. Well, now, who actually owns that car? You told everybody that it was yours. You were driving it around. You've got the keys to it. But is it really yours? Is it really your property? Or could it be that most of you people driving around with these cars actually don't own the cars? It's GMAC that owns the car, and you have an equitable interest in GMAC's car, kind of like renting a car from Hertz. Do you say, this is my car? Well, if you lease it, you do. Or if you rent it for any period of time, you know, people lease cars, and they say, hey, this is my car. Here's my car keys. Hey, Mary, have you got my car keys? You don't say, hey, Mary, have you got Hertz car keys? Hey, Mary, have you got the rental company's keys? I'd like to use the rental company's car. No, you say, this is mine. It's always possessory. You call this my wife. You call this my son. You call your child my daughter. Is that really your wife? Are there or could there be some other people out there or some entity somewhere that has a higher and better claim to your wife than you do? I know it sounds kind of crazy. You know, at least at first blush, you've been to public school, I'm sure. Now, we take a look at a child and we say, oh, it's my boy. Is it? Now, I don't know about you, but here where we live, we have a lady named Carla down the street over here, and she's what we call social lady. And social lady comes out, not too often, but once in a while, knocks on people's doors and says, well, I'm social lady, and I'm here to take your kids. She usually comes out with the sheriff or a couple of deputies, and there's usually weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth and crying and yelling and screaming. But, you know, in the final analysis, when the deal is finally consummated, Carla, the social lady, and the sheriff's deputies drive away with your children in their car, and they don't tell you where they're taking them. They put them into foster care, and they keep them there for a while, and then you got to come into court and explain to some people, judges, social worker, why it is that you're treating your children the way you do, or you're raising them or educating them the way you do. And in some cases, when the state decides that they don't like the way that you're raising their children, they just take them away permanently, terminate your parental rights, and that's the end of the argument. So let me ask you again, is that really your child? Is that really your wife? Is that really your car? Is that really your house, your home? Now, here in America, we've been practicing this first plank, you know, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. We've been practicing that in this country now for quite a long time. Was there ever a time when we did own houses that could not be taken by the state? We did have children without social ladies who could take them away from us against our will and over our objection. Was there ever a time when we owned automobiles or horses and buggies and wagons and things like that that the highway patrolman couldn't take? Well, surprisingly, yeah, there was. And then over time, something changed. Something came along, and all of a sudden, wives, children, automobiles, houses could be seized by the state or the state's agents and agencies against your will and over your objection. It's just been in the last 100 years. Could we identify what happened? What was the seminal event that caused this change? And is it a good thing or is it bad? Now, you know, most people don't complain too much about Social 80. And they don't complain too much about GMAC or Ford Motor Finance or the property tax and one thing and another. And I hear people constantly, they're talking about my kid and my child and my house and my business and my mine. They call me on the telephone and they say, oh my God, Mr. Gordon, a Social 80 came by and took my children. And I ask them, well, whose children were they? They're mine, they tell me. And I say, did you have a marriage license? Well, of course I did. Did you have birth certificates for the children? Well, yes, of course. And I muse to myself, now, this fellow is uninformed. He doesn't seem to understand the realities of the subject of property. He, honest to God, in his mind, believes that's my kid, my car, my house, and the reality of it is it isn't. So I just thought I'd take a look at this thing called the subject of property. It relates to property and property rights, and raise a couple, three questions, and let's see if we can't get to a point in time where could we actually own property? I mean, could you actually change things and get a house that's yours, and maybe have a child that's yours, and maybe have a car that's yours? Or is there any way that you could actually own some property, television set, or gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, that you could own, use, and enjoy to the exclusion of all others? Now listen to the definition of property from Bouvier's Law Dictionary. It's a pretty long definition, and there's quite a bit to be said, but property is the right and interest which a man has in lands and chattels to the exclusion of others. It is the sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. I underlined in the universe. That's a pretty all-encompassing term. If God himself claims to own the property, well, then you can't own it. Now, if you could claim a piece of property, anything, you know, a bag of marbles, a pack of chewing gum, and if you could exclude God Almighty from it, that would be property. Now, there are houses out there, but that doesn't mean that those houses constitute property. There are wives and children and automobiles and chattels, but that doesn't make it property. I know it sounds like property, it looks like property, but if Social 80 can take your kids, that's something that God himself can't do. I mean, the creator of the universe himself can't take your child. But Social 80 can. Now, God himself can't take your automobile, your house. I know some religious guy is going to say, well, God can just do anything he wants. No, he can't. He says plainly, he's the God that cannot lie. Now, you know, I can lie. I can tell the truth. God can't. He can only tell the truth. He suffers from a disability. He's got a disability that I don't have. I got a power that God Almighty doesn't have. He can't lie. Said so very plainly. Furthermore, this God follows his own law. So when he's got a law here that says, thou shalt not steal, if this car was yours and God came and took it away from you, hey son, you got a God that steals. And this is a God over here that says, thou shalt not steal. Now, I've got a couple of abilities that God doesn't have. I can let you keep your property or I can steal it from you, but he can't. That guy can't steal. I just wanted to throw that out to you, you know, so you'd get your bearings here a little bit. Now, that doesn't say that God isn't powerful. You know, I mean, this is a guy, you know, that can create universes in a week, and he can move planets around here and there, and he can destroy armies and destroy nations, and he can build them up, and he can do all kinds of neat stuff. He creates life, and he destroys life, but he doesn't steal, and he doesn't lie. How do you like that? Now, take a look at this again. It says here, the sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion. Wait a minute. If the highway patrolman can take your car, if Social 80 can take your kids, if GMAC can take your car, or the Bank of America can take your house, then you don't hold those properties to the total exclusion over the external things of the world, then do you? Kind of reminds me one time my daddy had a bicycle at Ward's Riverside. God, that thing was the greatest thing that God ever built on planet Earth. If God made anything better than the Ward's Riverside, he kept it for himself. And here it was all mine, white sidewall tires with a horn and light on it and paper carrier, and just cost $85, and that was 1949. I mean, that thing was it was like driving a Rolls Royce, you know. Anyway, one day my daddy got upset with me and he said, you're grounded, little Georgie. You're on foot. You put your bike up on the porch and you ain't riding for a week. Now, if you had asked me whose bike that was, I would have said, that's mine. That's my bike. And that was the first time that I had a direct run-in with this question of property rights. There was a contested issue of fact as to who owned this Ward's Riverside over here. Now, I got it for Christmas, and these people gave it to me, and they said it was mine. One day I woke up and I found out, oops, wait a minute. If my daddy can take that bicycle away from me for a week, then that must not be my bike. That must be my daddy's bike, and I'm using his bike during periods of good behavior. And if there's bad behavior or for some other reason, my daddy decides that he wants to take that away from me, he just does it anytime he wants to. God himself doesn't do that. I'll show you that as we progress along. But meanwhile, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. That's to keep all of the nations of the world and their federal communications commissions happy and satisfied with our program here. So let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by simply calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, if you have a computer and you're on the Internet, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, click onto our archives page and download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home, and then I don't have to send it to you in a plain brown paper package so that nobody will know what's coming. Hey, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct. That's to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, that doesn't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. We need to keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review, they could be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the subject of property. Property is the right and interest which a man has in lands and chattels. All right, now a chattel is a something. Land is land, property. But interest in chattels, that's automobiles, television sets, shoes and socks, dressers, furniture, all those thingies out there. Now there's one other thing out there called the subject of property which deals with rights. Rights. So I mentioned to you briefly that if you had a right in something over here, then that's property. And this latter consists in legal rights, such as a chose in action. And that's kind of a wild term, isn't it? It's called a chose in action, C-H-O-S-E, easements and the like. In a strict legal sense, land is not property, but rather it is the subject of property. The term property, although in common parlance applied to a tract of land or a chattel in its legal signification, means only the right of the owner in relation to the property. It denotes a right over a determinate thing. Property is the right of any person to possess, use, enjoy, and dispose of a thing. So if I owned something, I could dispose of it any way I want to. Now, I have my house here, and I've decided I want to dispose of it, and I want to dispose of it by fire. So I'm going to set it on fire and burn it to the ground. What do you think is going to happen to you if you set your house on fire? Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen. The fire department's going to come over and put the fire out. Then they're going to look for somebody that might have set the fire. And when they find out it's you, they're going to arrest you, jail you, prosecute you, and lock you up in the slammer for a few years. So that ought to dispel any belief that you might have that the home that you live in is your property. I mean, you put that out of your mind, son. If you think that your child is your property, then let me see you whip your kid, take him out of the public school, or do something with that with that child that the state has prohibited, and then let's watch and see what social aid does and see how long you can keep that kid. Now, that ought to dispense any notion in your mind that that child is your property. Now, I know many people are going to write me an email or a letter, and they're going to say, why, people can't own people. Oh, yeah, they can. Sure they can. Well, we used to. We called them bondservants and slaves, and then somebody woke up and wrote a law called the 13th Amendment and said, oh, no, we can't have bond servitude and slavery. It was a good thing we did that, too, because, see, God made a bad mistake when he created bond servitude and slavery. Thank God we had President Lincoln to come along there and fix God's mistake. The creator of the universe was just full of mistakes. You know, he's really pretty damn dumb when you stop to think about it. Coming up with slavery, bond servitude, Passover, Feast of Tabernacles. I mean, come on. We all know that Christmas, Easter, and New Year's are the proper holy days and holidays. This Leviticus 23 crap, you know, needs to be fixed. Thank God we've got seminaries and preachers out here that can fix all of these crazy mistakes that God has made. So when we're talking about property over here, you know, hey, listen, God has made some bad mistakes concerning property, but fortunately, we've got legislatures, we've got presidents, senators, representatives, and others, you know, college professors and so on that can fix all these mistakes. But I just thought that I'd bring to your attention some salient facts. Here in America, we don't practice private property rights. We practice the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. We have abolished private property and private ownership of property. We don't practice that in this country. We practice here from each according to his ability and to each according to his needs. And we're pretty damn happy doing that too. So I just want to let everybody know that. Now, after we get through with the right to property is done in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe, including God himself, the right to possess, use, enjoy, and dispose of a thing is the way we determine whether or not it's your property. It's the right that you possess to use it, to enjoy it, and dispose of it. Well, now, does the government ever come in, or does anybody else ever come in and tell you how to use something? I mean, you got an automobile here, see, and then you want to drive your car. I mean, it's got a speedometer on there that says 120. Can you just take that out there on the highway and drive at 120, or is there somebody out there telling you how to use it? I know somebody's going to say, well, you've got to have rules out there that tell people how to use it. Okay, I don't deny it. But if you can't use something the way you want to use it, then it's a disability, isn't it? And then if you've got this disability, you know, like I want to burn my house to the ground, it's mine. And somebody comes along and says, no, you can't do that. And if you try, we'll punish you. Well, then, obviously, then you don't have a property right in that thing. Now, you might have an equitable interest. I don't deny it, but it isn't property. So when you run around saying, hey, this is mine or that's mine, I thought you ought to know, well, if it was yours, you could burn it to the ground. And if that was your car, you could drive it 120 miles an hour. And the fact that you can't do either tells you very plainly then it's not yours. Just like my daddy told me that I couldn't use that Ward's Riverside for a week, that told me whose that bike was. I thought it was mine, but I found out, nope, it weren't mine. I could use it during some periods of time. Now the state comes along and says, now we'll let you use your automobile, but we're going to tell you how to use it and where to use it and how much it's going to cost you to use it. In fact, the state where I live, we have more than 2,000 laws, rules, regulations, customs, usages, and practices that attach to automobiles. And you have to follow those 2,000 rules in order to use the state's automobile. And the reason that we know that it's the state's automobile is because the state has its identification plates on both ends of the car. It says very plainly, Iowa, Missouri, California. I mean, you don't have a plate on your car that says Bob Finkelstein now, do you? You know, I'd think that if that was your car, you'd have your name on it. That's what I used to do when I went to school, you know, when I had a book or something like that. I put my name in the book, and that identified that book as being mine. See? Now, you don't run around here with your name on your car. You run around here with the state of Missouri's name on your car. Well, hell, that tells you whose car that is, doesn't it? All right. That's just so that you don't get, you know, a big head and think that you own automobiles or something like that. And there's a way for you to dispose of this thing. Hey, listen, you got to dispose of this car in an ecologically approved manner. I mean, you know, the state prescribes modalities for the disposal of automobiles. That's not left to you, Bob. All right, going on, Bouvier tells us that which is in itself valuable, the free use and enjoyment by a person of all of his acquisitions without any control or diminution save only by the law of the land. Now, I'm going to underline this law of the land. Do you know what that is? That's not the legislature's law of your state. The law of the land is the common law. The law of the land is the law of God that we got from Mount Sinai. It's commonly called the common law. The common law. Except by the common law. Now, God has given us some laws, rules, and regulations. I wouldn't deny that. There are some things that you can do and some things that you can't do. There are 759 of them, to be precise. And they're organized into 133 subjects. And then he says, you know, do this, don't do that, you know, just like your state does. And there's always somebody out there spoiling your fun, telling you what to do. And he's one of them. Now, except by the law of the land, you have the free use and enjoyment by a person of all of his acquisitions. So when you acquire something, automobiles, children, wives, houses, big screen TVs, you know, whatever it is, you have the total use of it. And you can also have the total right to dispose of it any way you want to. And if we take that right of disposal away from you and we dictate to you, well, then we take away your property right. And it can't be diminished. If I can diminish it to some degree, well, then you don't have a property right there. And you don't have property. You've got something else, but you don't have property. Now, the right of a person over a thing in rem, indefinite in point of user. Literally taken, the word is nomen generalissimum, but is not always so used. As ordinarily used, it means the thing possessed, but it may include the right to use and enjoy it. The more comprehensive meaning is presumed to have been intended by the use of such a word in a constitution, that which is peculiar or proper to any person, that which belongs exclusively to one. The first meaning of the word from which it is derived is one's own. A vested right of action is property, in the same sense that tangible things are property. It is a thing owned, that to which a person has or may have a legal title. Have you got a legal title to your automobile? Now that's a neat question. Have you got legal title to your automobile? Most people would say, well, of course I do. I have the title. Well, assuming that you made all your payments and a GMAC sent you one. Well, Walt Mann wrote a little piece concerning that. As it devolves upon a thing called superior title, listen to this. Superior title. Such law merchant and code law merchant title is called superior title. Superior title means superior to mere possessory common law title. Possessory. Superior title is something more important and more powerful than possession. And it provides that irrespective of who possesses the property, the real owner is that entity which has actual or constructive possession of the document of title. And I know sometimes people will say, well, I have the title to my car. Oh, do you now? I would be surprised if you have the title to your car. In fact, let me challenge you. Go pull out the title to your car and read it. I'll bet you you've never done that before. It'll be a wild new experience for you. Go get your document of title. And I think it's going to say right across the front, certificate of title. That's right. I think it's going to say certificate of title. Furthermore, if you look in the watermark on this certificate of title, I think the watermark will say void, void, void all over. Do you know what void means? Do you know what certificate means? That certificate of title means exactly what it says. It says, this is a piece of paper, a certificate, that tells you that there is a title. This piece of paper isn't the title, but it tells you that there is one someplace. So a legal question devolves upon, gee, where is this legal title and who possesses it? All right, so now one more little factoid comes into play. Corporations thus hold for themselves and as agent for governments all documents of title, and they do not deliver these documents of title to the new possessor, whereby the unsuspecting buyer obtains only inferior title. So among other things, it is only the delivery and the intent to deliver the document of title which evidences the true intent to transfer the true prior superior title, as is the case with all law merchant paper titles and negotiable instruments. So you go in to buy a new car, and so the car dealer, he signs you up and he gives you a bunch of papers to sign that you never read, don't know what the hell you're signing, but you sign them all, and he says, I'll take care of everything. And he sends in the papers. Well, one of the papers that he sends in that you didn't see and can't have is called the Manufacturer's Certificate of Origin. It's the document of title, manufactured, made by, and attaches to the automobile by the Ford Motor Company. Now, the state gets this MSO, or the MCO, and you get a certificate of title, and the state has the title to the automobile, which tells us what? In such law merchant, code law merchant title, we call this superior title. You bet you've got title. You've got the highest and best interest in the use of the car, just like you do when you rent it from Hertz. You've got a better title, and you've got more use to that Hertz car than I do. And if I come along and take that Hertz car, and you've got the lease to it, God, they're going to grab me and haul me off and throw me in the slammer. But the fact that you've got a better use or better right to use the automobile than I do doesn't mean that you own the car now, does it? Do you think you can dispose of that Hertz car any way you want to? Well, now that tells you a whole bunch, doesn't it? Now, governments between 1890 and 1927 adopted this law merchant as the supreme rule of property ownership and title. It's called the Uniform Commercial Code. And it attaches particularly to documents of title and the provisions thereof. Now, isn't that just real special? So it's the law merchant that governs. And as prior law governing this thing called the UCC at 1-103 holds that the law merchant shall govern, and where the code doesn't apply, even aids where the UCC and other code provisions do apply. Where government involves itself in property, and particularly commercial law merchant property concerns, it loses its governmental dignity and immunity and descends to the level of a mere private corporation. And additionally, government must make its proprietary interests overtly known by notice and special factual allegation, pleading, and proofs in any litigation, whether in courts or before agencies. And without such, it can lose such interest and control. That's why you have to register your car every year, boys and girls, and you have to pay the state a fee to drive the state's car, called registration. And you have to put the state's identification tags on the car. They insist on it. And if they let you do something else, they would lose title to the property. They don't want to do that. After all, you're a cash cow. And you're paying money every year, aren't you, to drive the state's car. Well, how about living with the state's woman and raising the state's children? We'll talk about that next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, but I'm out of time, so I've got to remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.